Thank you. Thank you very much for that introduction to Robert and the talk. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Robert is genuinely sad not to be with you in person. He has been to talk once before and loved it, and has promised me he will come back. Obviously, the election has turned TV schedules upside down, and ITV insisted that he stay in London for a broadcast tonight. So what he did, he rearranged his schedule. I met up with Robert this morning, and we recorded an extensive and extended conversation to show to you for the first time. I haven't seen it myself. It's unedited, so it runs at about 70 minutes, so a little bit longer than the 60-minute slot. And while we do cover many of the ideas in his book, I was obviously incredibly interested to get his take on the election, how it compared to past elections, and what we can hope for in the near term on the other side of this election. So without further ado, I will hand over to the screen and the conversation Robert and I had this morning. Thank you very much. Robert, thank you so much for taking time out from an incredibly busy election schedule to join us here in the Spotify studio. Obviously, I know that we're very sorry that you can't join us in Chalk, in Wiltshire itself, but great that we have this opportunity to chat. I wanted to open, we're 11 days away from the election. If the polls are to be believed, and they all agree, it looks like we'll have a Labour government on the other side of that. How does this election feel different to previous ones? You've been reporting for 40 years. You've written, been writing for 20.
Thanks for reminding me how old I am. But anyway, yeah, keep going.
You've been near the centre of power for a very, very long time. Is this time special or different?
So before I start, I do just want to say to those of you watching and listening how sad I am not to be at Chalk. It's a fantastic festival. I love doing it. And if it hadn't been for blooming Rishi Sunak, I'd be with you all. But I mean, let's think of this as a very, very special Rest His Money podcast, because it's only for you as opposed to hundreds of thousands of other people. So we're trying to make this as special as possible. Now, I mean, in terms of this election, yes, it is the weirdest election I have ever had to report on and make sense of, and for a number of reasons. The most important one is simply that there has never been a British general election where one of the two big parties, and in this case the ruling Conservative Party, in effect conceded defeat, more or less midway through the campaign, in that one of the only two big themes that it is pushing is, to summarise, Labour's won, and what you voters can decide is whether Labour becomes what you might call an elected dictatorship with an enormous, off the charts, historically large majority, or whether, in the end, you, the voters, although you may be fed up with, us, the Tories, whether you want to nonetheless vote for us in enough numbers that mean that the Labour majority will be a slightly smaller, more conventional majority. I mean, it's really an astonishing thing for a party leader, an astonishing thing for Rishi Sunak to be saying. I was political editor of the FT in the 90s, and I was absolutely immersed in the run-up to the 1997 general election. In fact, I've written sort of two books about it, one a work of fiction called The Whistleblower and another a work of non-fiction, my first non-fiction book, a book about actually Gordon Brown called Brown's Britain. And So absolutely immersed in that general election. And even though it was absolutely clear to me that Labour was going to win, the Tories, at least during that campaign, kept up the conceit that they stood a chance. In fact, I mean, Michael Heseltine, who was John Major's deputy, kept saying right up till polling day that the Tories were going to win with an enormous majority. Now, it was mad, but, you know, he took the view, which is not unreasonable, that if you're going to have any chance of campaigning in any kind of credible way, at least you've got to pretend you've got a chance of winning. And there is something really extraordinary about this Tory campaign, that, as I say, they have, in effect, conceded defeat.
Now, in 97, you had New Labour, you had Blair and Brown. They had a slew of ideas that were on the table about how, to their mind, they were going to make Britain better. It seems, at the moment, that Keir Starmer's Labour is campaigning on a steady-as-she-goes prospectus. It doesn't seem that this is an election about ideas. Now, I may be wrong in that, but can we expect change of the order that we need to put Britain back on its feet again from the Labour government?
So I need to say a couple of things about that. I mean, first of all, in terms of the first term of a Labour government, the most important economic reform that they carried out, and they carried it out within, I mean, they announced it, you know, the day after the general election, which was giving control of interest rates to the Bank of England, probably the most important reform to the way we manage this economy, possibly since the war. I mean, it was a really significant transfer of policy-making power to the Bank of England, independent control of the interest rates, of interest rates. But the point about that is it was not in their manifesto, and they kept it. I mean, even though Gordon Brown had given a series of speeches in the run-up to polling day, which were all consistent with the idea that it would be sensible to take the politics out of interest rate setting, they didn't announce it. It was a massive shock inside the Treasury, in fact. When Brown and Balls got inside the Treasury, there was initially a bit of sucking in of teeth from Treasury officials and saying, well, we've just got to take our time over this, plan it carefully. And I think there were two things. One is that actually, to an extent in secret, Brown and Balls and their team had prepared the ground in opposition for how to do it. And secondly, they just said, no, if we're going to get it done, we've got to literally operationalize it immediately. So without the law going through, they immediately, in a sense, gave that power to the Bank of England in a less formal sense, and then legislated for it. And it was a it was not only an important economic reform, but as a statement of intent about who was in charge, you know, Blair and Brown, as opposed to the civil service, if you see what I
mean.
Yes,
yeah.
It was incredibly important, and it gave a signal to the wider electorate that this was a government determined to drive through change. So it had both real economic effect and symbolic effect.
So we might see...
So now let's get to Starmer's Labour. An important thing to remember about Starmer's Labour is that 2 years ago, they did not expect to be in this position. You know, we should all remember, however much it now...
And by this position, you mean so clearly in the lead?
that, yeah, they just, you know, 2 years ago, they did not expect to be in a position where they would win this election, right? And that's completely understandable. I mean, you know, in 2019, in the last election, Boris Johnson won an 80-seat majority, a very significant working majority. There was something like a sort of 8 or 9 percentage point gap between Labour and the Tories in terms of the national vote. That is not the kind of deficit you would normally be able to reverse in the course of a single parliament. And all that, and but this has not been a normal parliament for all the reasons we know, a combination of incompetence by this government, huge shocks, external shocks, whether it's COVID, for example, whether it's the ethical challenges that they've faced. You know, Boris Johnson found guilty of lying by Parliament, Liz Truss causing this incredible financial markets crisis with her mini budget. You put all these things together, you know, of course, you know, the natural consequence of all of that is the opposition party is going to do very well. But none of those things were forecastable, certainly back in 2019. Or at least certainly all of them weren't forecastable back in 2019. You know, although, you know, some would say the notion that, you know, Boris Johnson turned out to be economical with the truth, it's not something that
not very surprising.
Yeah. But anyway, let's just focus on the big point, which is that unlike New Labour, which had sort of had, well, it certainly had a good 5 years to prepare for government. Yeah. But actually, you know, if you think about it, you know, in the run-up to the 92 election, they also did a lot of preparatory work to make themselves more credible for government. So you could argue that, you know, the Labour Party had been preparing for government in a serious way for 7 or 8 years, and this lot have really been preparing for government in a serious way for, I don't know, 18 months or something. So there's a lot of work to be done. They've had to bring in enormous numbers of new people to help them at quite a late stage. And so it isn't surprising that what we have with a, you know, this Starmer Labour Party is a lot of big ambitions. And I do think that the scale of the ambitions are not to be sniffed at, but the problem is that there is not as yet a lot of detail about how to realise those ambitions. And probably the most the most important ambition is to significantly increase the rate of growth in the economy. That is absolutely the right ambition, and we're
going to get into that.
Back to
that, yes,
when we talk about, you know, my book Bust. And they have outlined in general terms some of the things they need to do to achieve that, but the detail behind it is as yet lacking. Now, you also asked me a very specific question, which is, will there be a Bank of England independence moment early in the life of this Labour government if they are elected? And look, I've got to be honest, if there is, I'm not sure what it would be. It's theoretically possible they're keeping something incredibly significant in terms of that aim of getting the growth rate up. I mean, if I'm honest with you, the reason I'm feeling slightly challenged about what it might be is because when it comes to getting the growth rate up, there is no single, you know, use that awful expression, silver bullet. You have to change the economy in multiple ways to start seeing productivity, output per person, output per worker rising. You have to change the economy in multiple ways to make sure that the fruits of any growth that you generate are distributed in a way that is fairer. So, you know, so I do think just very briefly on this, they probably will say something reasonably significant quite quickly about how they will change the planning system. And that is important because our inability, whether it's to do big power projects or big housing projects, big development projects, our inability to do that is holding back growth. But even if they make an announcement on planning that seems big and significant, it's, you know, there are lots of other things they would need to do as well.
Yeah. So coming on to your book, Bust. Saving the Economy, Democracy and Our Sanity.
So it's important to focus on the positive side of things, because although it's an analysis of what's gone wrong, the point of the book was actually to come up with a whole series of proposals that were designed to say, you know, there is hope so long as we make some bold decisions.
Right. So why, there were two things that really struck me about how you approach this on the surface. One, that you co-authored it with Kishan Koria, who's your producer of The Peston Show. And so first of all, why did you decide to co-author it, and why with Kishan?
There were two reasons, one sort of more honourable than the other. The honourable reason was part of what's gone wrong is the very destructively unfair distribution of wealth in this country. Broadly, all the property and assets are owned by people of my generation, and he's from a much younger generation who've struggled to get on the housing ladder, struggled to save in different ways. And so I felt, given that I regard this as one of the flaws in the British economy, it was useful and important to have the insights of somebody from that younger generation. And Kish is somebody I've worked with now for 10 years, pretty much. It'll be getting on for 10 years next year. He's exceptionally bright, exceptionally insightful. So I knew he's going to be a great partner in this project. And secondly, because I was also finishing off a thriller at the same time, I actually just thought I'd probably be quite helpful, even though I do write very fast and, I love writing. I just thought actually having a partner who can sort of, do that really important thing in life of just saying, actually, Robert, what you've just suggested there is completely crazy. I'm not sure you should go down that path. He has lots of ideas of his own, but also he's just one of those very important people in one's life who just whispers in your ear, maybe you shouldn't say that.
And the other thing that really struck me about this book was the specificity. At the end, there's a long list of suggestions, of questions, policy questions. And I love that, because that's really starting a debate. That was part of the idea of doing that, would be that you would start a debate. You tried very hard to take ideas from the left and the right. And also, you were very explicit that these suggestions weren't comprehensive. This isn't a massive manifesto. It's not even a contract.
Well, it might be more of a manifesto than we've just seen from the two parties.
Well, this is it.
Let's be absolutely clear, because there are probably more ideas in this book than there are in those manifestos. But yeah, go on.
You've always made suggestions, but I think it's a brave thing for a journalist to do, because they leave themselves open for accusations of bias, or your flags are pinned to a certain mast. We have a culture in the UK from the BBC about being very even-handed, which you are. But did you consider that when you were working through these ideas at all? Why did you want to list them out in so explicit a manner?
So this goes to the heart of if you do my kind of job, what your responsibilities are. And obviously, as a broadcaster, I have specific responsibilities in my day job at ITV to be impartial. But to be clear, That's never been a problem for me. I tried to do the same thing when I was in newspapers for a long time at the Financial Times, a decade, for a slightly shorter time actually at the Telegraph. And I've never been interested in propaganda. But that doesn't mean that I'm restricted from having views. I've always had views, and you know, if you watch my show or you watch me on the news, you will hear me express a view. But under the impartiality rules, I am entitled to express a view that is grounded in serious research, serious analysis. And you know, what I've always done is said. So this became in a way controversial for me during the referendum about whether we should leave the European Union, because night after night on ITV, I said, if we leave the European Union, we will be poorer, because this is, and I would then explain the economics of it, why we would be poorer. And I also said, by the way, you know, there may be other reasons why you want to leave the European Union. You might be somebody who thinks that it's more important for Parliament to have control over certain elements of lawmaking, the so-called sovereignty argument, or you might be very concerned about immigration, and you might think that if we leave the EU, we'll have more control over immigration. And so for lots of people who voted for Brexit on that basis, they've been very disappointed by the fact that immigration numbers have risen. But what I did say night after night, and it upset quite a lot of people, we're going to be poorer if we leave. And what was important is that the main campaign to leave the EU, the one fronted by Boris Johnson and led by Dominic Cummings, complained to Ofcom that what I was saying breached impartiality rules. And Ofcom were very clear that what I'd said did not breach impartiality rules because I'd shown my working, as right. it were. And anyway, let's be clear, even if I hadn't shown my working, truth is, the economics around this is pretty basic, and it was a very straightforward thing to be able to say. It was a slight sort of surprise to me, having only recently left the BBC, that the BBC didn't say that. They decided that impartiality was, that their definition of impartiality was rather different from mine.
The two sides argument.
And so they basically, they confused their viewers, yeah. because they basically had on, you know, on their programmes, two different people, one arguing that Brexit was going to make us richer, another saying that Brexit was going to make us poorer. And then they said to the poor viewers, now you're going to have to choose which of these is right. And I felt that was not, I did feel at the time, the BBC was not doing, you know, its public service job. We did it differently at ITV. And I think, you know, we adopted what I regard as the appropriate public service approach. And so although there are lots of suggestions and ideas in this book for change, I can take any of us through the steps that lead me to those conclusions. They're all implicit in the book anyway, and therefore I don't think anybody could read this and say that I am biased in the sense that matters. So I do think if people thought I was a Labour Party propagandist or a Tory Party propagandist or a Green Party propagandist, then it would be very hard for me to do my job. But I defy anybody to read this book and put a party label on me. I mean, partly because quite a lot of what's in this book is not currently adopted by any of these blooming parties, and maybe they should adopt some of these ideas.
So there's two things that really sort of suffuse everything. One is, and we'll talk about both, but just to headline them here, one is this need for economic growth. And I want to get into more detail about that. And then the other is this sense that technology, in its broader sense, and more specifically artificial intelligence, and specifically generative artificial intelligence, so the flavor that generates new stuff, and it does it through, you know, through the ability to go through huge amounts of data, so that is somehow going to change our lives. It's going to infect every part of our lives, business, social, government. Why do you, well, firstly, do you use AI? And in speaking to business leaders and those in government, what do you see their concerns, or how are they adopting AI and seeing how it'll change businesses? What's the evidence that it's going to change everything?
So I'm going to start with a very bold statement, which is actually, this is increasingly being accepted. And we'll come back to the politics of all this, because I think the politics is really important. But, you know, the bold statement is this is the most powerful, most important industrial revolution any of us have lived through. And, you know, there is an argument, which I genuinely believe, that this could be as important to reshaping our economy as, you know, that initial steam industrial revolution.
Yeah.
And the thing that I suppose disappoints me most about this general election, and I suspect it's going to disappoint me when we get into the red hot phase of the American presidential election, is this stuff about how you harness AI for good ought to have been actually dominating all the parties' manifestos. It ought to have been the stuff we were hearing every day on the stump from candidates and indeed the leaders, and we've heard almost nothing about it.
Is that because it's too technical, or it doesn't affect most of us yet, or?
I just think it is, I'm afraid, a sad reflection of the way that our leaders and our politicians are out of touch with, you know, some of the big shifts that are going on in the world, and you know that should concern us. And so you asked me a question: do I use generative AI? Yes, I use, you know, GPT-40 every single day repeatedly to do all sorts of things, from research through to processing data. You know, I mean, for example, I do quite a lot of you know, trying to work out trends, and you know, in terms of generating graphs or analyzing trends, it cuts out so much time. Right, it's amazing, right? So just on a personal level, it's increased my productivity really very significantly.
Which, to be clear, wasn't very poor to start with. I mean, that's a sort of terrifying thought.
Well, I mean, it's certainly true that most of my nearest and dearest, you know, would sort of slightly say that I'm slightly too obsessed with work. But yeah, all right, let's move on from that. But it's obviously dangerous to extrapolate from the personal experience to sort of, you know, the entire economy. But the reality is, you know, that I speak obviously to, you know, business leaders all the time. Every single one of them is looking at how to adapt AI to improve the productivity of, across their businesses. It is, absolutely the obsession of pretty much every business, certainly any business that wants to stay in business. Obviously, there are, unfortunately, businesses that aren't attuned enough to changes in the world, and some of them are going to struggle because they're not thinking hard enough now about how to make the most of this. But in economic terms, the reason why this is so important is because it is doing two things, generative AI. And if we move to this, so-called point of singularity where you have generative AI, artificial general intelligence, which can do everything that we can as humans do, but better. And, you know, maybe that's 5 years away, maybe that's 10 years away, none of us know. But it's perfectly reasonable to prepare for that moment. The way to think about this challenge is like this. On the one hand, it is already making individuals more productive. And that in itself presents a whole range of public policy challenges. One of them is, will this lead to businesses to get rid of people? Because they will need fewer of them. Another is, do we have a structure of an economy where these increases in productivity will be reflected in the wages that people are paid? Will wages go up to capture that increased productivity? Now, on both of those questions, there are reasons to be slightly concerned, right? If you just look at what has been happening with, you know, recent digital revolutions, it's perfectly clear, dawn of the internet, dawn of social media and all the rest of it, the vast majority of the extra value that's been created has been scooped by investors and founders. And it has been associated with a massive widening of the inequality gap.
Right. The gig economy is part of that. Obviously, these large companies are even if they're based in Europe, they're not based in the UK. So tax receipts.
And so a public policy challenge, and this is something that is a lesson of all industrial revolutions. You go back to the first industrial revolution, there is this period now known as Engels' pause after the great collaborator with Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels. And Engels' pause was that very long period in that first industrial revolution.
Like where, 60, 70 years, something like that?
I mean, people, there's some dispute about quite how long it was, right. But it was certainly decades.
Yeah.
And over that period, the living standards of factory workers stagnated and indeed for a period fell. They, you know, people's lives did not get better for an extended period. And that should be a warning about where we are now. Now, the other thing about artificial general intelligence, if it comes, is you will hear these utopian accounts that it will create this so-called world of plenty, because in effect, robots will be able to do everything that we do. And in those circumstances, you know, we could all just sit back and have a life of leisure. Now, you know, whether or not you really believe that is coming, let's just say some version of lots of jobs will go. As I say, let's just say there's a hybrid of some people becoming more productive, some jobs just going completely. In that world, these are the priorities, right? You've got to have a world where people are retrained for whatever new jobs emerge, because there will be new jobs that emerge. And so you need a whole different kind of education system. You partly have to change the way that you teach in schools, but you've also got to have, you know, educational institutions for adults. That's going to have and some of that training actually may be about new jobs. Some of it may just be how you have a rich life without a conventional job. So there are really big sort of social questions. Questions about what the good society looks like that arise. Then there's another set of issues about the welfare state, right? I mean, you know, we don't want, surely, to relive what happened during the 1980s with the closure of mines and heavy industry, where people, you know, when they lost those jobs, were written off. Yeah. Whole communities were destroyed. In the Thatcher Revolution, which undoubtedly made the British economy more competitive, the social cost of that was too great, because entire communities in the North and Midlands were damaged for decades. And we're still actually getting the bitter harvest of all of that. But, you know, part of the reason our politics is so angry and fractured is there are still lots of people in the Midlands and North who just say, this economy doesn't run for me, you ignore me, the opportunities to have a prosperous life where I live are not good enough. And a lot of that can be traced back to the 80s. And we just don't want to see, you know, if we're now going to see the complete hollowing out of entire service industries, many of which are actually in the sort of South, we don't want to see people written off, right? So you've got to give them, you know, you've got to make sure that as they retrain, you have a welfare system that supports them. One of the things we talk about in BUST is about you need to reconfigure the welfare system so people have a decent income during the period, not forever, but a decent income during the period that they retrain. And secondly, I know there's been a lot of talk about this, and we know that it is very hard to redesign the welfare system to give what's known as a universal basic income. But AI, I think, does make it now urgent that the really important technical work is done to make, you know, to prepare societies for a world in which everybody can have that basic standard of living through, I'm afraid, you know, it'll have to be a combination of taxation on those who are making super normal profits as a result of this AI revolution, with distribution to vast numbers of people who would otherwise be victims.
Yeah. So you raise there sort of tacitly, we come back to this question of economic growth. Is there, and following this, we'll get onto some of the proposals that you make in Bust. But just so we understand this, we're clear on this. I mean, the economy has been growing at 1% a year on average for the past sort of 10, 15 years. So there's one question about why is that not sufficient? And then there's another point is what kind of growth in the economy do we need to feel the benefit of it? Is any economic growth good, or is some preferable over others?
So look, sustainable economic growth in a climate change, in a sort of climate change framing, is obviously what you want. You don't want economic growth that, you know, massively increases carbon emissions. In fact, what you want is economic growth that is consistent with reducing carbon emissions. And, you know, although this is not something that the UK can achieve on its own, because we're a relatively small economy, we are an influential economy, we're an influential country, and, you know, we do not want to get into the beggar my neighbour space where we simply say, oh, well, because China's not doing it, we're not going to adapt our economy. In fact, China is beginning to adapt it. Well, not beginning, it's actually investing enormous sums in adapting its economy. You could argue it's not going fast enough, and I think I would agree it's not going fast enough. But, you know, I do think that there's a moral obligation on the UK to grow in a way that doesn't lead to, you know, massively increased carbon emissions. As I say, I'm firmly committed to the net zero targets. So that's one thing. Secondly, I think it's important to put that 1% since, on average, it's just over, I think it's 1.1% since 2008, the average growth rate. Just to put that into context, from 92 to 2007, the growth rate in this country was 2.8%. And so you're looking at, you know, almost a two-thirds fall in the growth rate since the financial crash. If we had a society where, you know, we had a consensus and a degree of solidarity that, you know, it was important that, you know, income and wealth over a certain level was essentially too much, and income and wealth below a certain level was too little. And then you just had a consensus that you would have this form of redistribution from, you know, those with most to those with least. You could definitely, you know, function perfectly effectively with 1% growth. The problem is, you know, in our electoral system, you know, those who don't think of themselves as, you know, that rich or that wealthy, you know, will not vote for a party that it thinks is gonna, you know, take too much of their hard, you know, their hard-won gains. And therefore, in our kind of political system, it's incredibly difficult to create, you know, a sort of decent standard of living and decent public services on the back of 1% growth. And, you know, we might, in a utopian way, wish that wasn't true. Yeah. But I'm afraid you know, the political system is such that it does make it very difficult to do everything from what you might call redistribution as opposed to distribution. The advantage of growing the cake faster than 1% is that you can transfer, in effect, from those with most to those with least, without those at the top feeling that they're getting poorer, because they're not getting poorer, because basically what you're doing is you're scooping off some of the incremental growth, but they're still getting richer, right? So just growing the cake makes it easier effectively to tax people at the top and get the money you need. There is a second reason why 1% growth is very, very challenging, even if you had a greater sense of social solidarity and more of a sense from the rich that they're prepared to pay more. And that is demographics, which is when you have a society which is aging as fast as ours is, and you have a society in which people are having fewer children in the way that ours is, and you have a society where there is, you know, a lot of unhappiness about the pace of immigration, then in those circumstances, the costs of supporting the elderly, the retired, whether it's pensions or the enormous costs of healthcare, the NHS, are such that, again, on the back of 1% growth, it's incredibly hard to generate the income that will, you know, pay those pensions and pay for that health service. And so in the end, you know, it is right. I mean, let's be clear, there's no guarantee that even if they massively reform the planning system in the way that I've already discussed, even if they do something again, which I think is very sensible, which is devolve decision-making about, you know, really important economic questions much more to mayors, or to regional decision-making institutions, because on the whole, the closer you are to the needs of a local community, the more likely it is you'll make rational decisions about what needs to happen there. Even if they make these structural changes, they may not get the growth rate up as much as they, and we, you know, they would like and we need. But I absolutely take the view that it's worth a go, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are two things, just to go back. So I do think AI and artificial intelligence, you know, harnessed in the right way, should get back to why it's so exciting. You know, because it is not a fairly conservative estimate is to say that artificial intelligence would increase productivity by maybe 1%, maybe 1.5 percentage points a year, right? If it puts up the growth rate, let's just say if you're growing at 1% and AI means you're growing at 2%, which is theoretically possible, that's a massive step change, which is another reason why you would want governments or leaders to be looking at how do we harness this? How do we harness it within the public sector apart from the others? Because again, you know, just
the cost savings.
Just the cost savings within the public sector could be off the charts if, again, harnessed in the right kind of way. So there's an enormous opportunity here for any government that wants to generate. There's an enormous opportunity here for any government that wants to generate growth. It's why broadly I'm an optimist about the future, so long as we get leadership.
So in terms of attracting, I'm going to come on now to some of the suggestions you make in the book. So in terms of attracting the very best people into public service, you know, there has been a complaint across the board that the quality of our MPs is not what it should be. And you make suggestions on that. You make suggestions on how to reform the House of Lords. The Labour Party have committed to abolishing the House of Lords.
Although not in the first parliament.
With not in the first parliament, exactly. And there was a reporting over the weekend that the lists were being drawn up to sort of appoint more peers.
Yeah, pack the house again. I mean, again, it's one of the things that's really depressing about the current system is whenever you pack the House of Lords with political appointees, it looks like a rigged system.
Yeah.
It brings the institution into even more disrepute. So you've got a party about to come into government that says it doesn't think the current upper house, exactly a beacon of a thriving democracy. And yet it's about to, essentially bring it into even more disrepute because it basically takes a view it won't be able to govern unless it has a significant number of, peers on its side. So I'll just talk you through, my proposals for electoral reform. The first one is we definitely need a more proportional method of voting. I do think first past the post is... there was a period when we took the view in the UK that first past the post delivered stable, strong governments. I think it's quite difficult, if you go back to 2010, to argue that since 2010... first past the post has been this sort of glittering jewel of British democracy. I would argue that it's neither produced rational government or strong government since 2010, and therefore I think the moment for change has come, and I suspect that will become if you look at the current projections for what could happen in this election, there are, YouGov in particular, which is regarded as sort of the gold standard of, we'll see whether YouGov gets it right, but YouGov is sort of regarded as the gold standard of these so-called MRP polls. YouGov is currently projecting that Labour could get just 38% of the vote and yet win an absolutely enormous majority, a record post-war majority.
And by contrast, and reform could get, in the teens and potentially get no seats, whatever.
Maybe just a very small number of seats. So if you're reform, which is why Nigel Farage is in favour of electoral reform, because if you're a reform supporter, you would say you're not being represented, as would Green voters, as would Lib Dems voters. They would all say we are disenfranchised by the current system. But that's sort of always been the way in British politics, that if you backed a small party, you sort of had to accept that you were sort of making a protest vote, you were wearing a badge, but you sort of acknowledged that your influence was the vote might help influence, but you were never going to have a party in power. The difference this time, and I think this is quite significant, is if it came to pass that Starmer had what looks like an elected dictatorship on 38% of the vote, that is fewer votes than Jeremy Corbyn got in 2017, when they weren't anywhere near the largest party, right? And so there is something paradoxical about a system in which Corbyn can get 40% in 2017 and be a million miles from power, and in theory Starmer gets 38% and is the most powerful prime minister since the war, right? So, and that, I think to many people, that won't feel right. And it will feel even worse if, as also seems like, because there's a lot of disillusioned people out there. One of the things that this book is all about, Bust, is about trying to give hope back to people. But that hope, that sense, the hopelessness of many people may be translated into people not voting. So if the turnout falls and you get a lower turnout and Labour with, let's say, 38%, then Labour could have this incredibly powerful position in government on the basis of at least 75% of those eligible to vote having backed other parties or no party at all. So, to be powerful on the back of just a quarter of British people, that powerful, doesn't feel right, I think, to many, to many. So I do think that there will be a bit more of a campaign, I suspect, after the election to reform. I think there'll be a lot more pressure after the election to reform the electoral system to make it more proportional.
And there are different kinds of proportional votes. You've got the alternative vote, which we had a referendum on, as well as, you know, straight proportionality, and there's different.
So I'm broadly in favour of straight proportionality, and so part of the proposal of the book is this: that you have fewer people in the House that proposes and shapes legislation that forms the government. You know, I think
so. You can pay them more
You know, we've got over 600 MPs. If you shrunk it to nearer 200, you could treble what they're paid, which without increasing.
So 90k to.
So I think it's not unreasonable, to pay a smaller number of MPs dedicated to the task of producing better legislation. You know, somewhere nearer to, you know, £250,000-£300,000 a year. Lots of people have shouted at me the idea that we should pay MPs that much. And it is an enormous amount of money. I just want to be absolutely clear. I'm under no illusion that for most British people, that's an enormous amount of money. But, you know, bright people are capable of earning multiples of that. Whether they're working in finance or in AI even frankly in vast swathes of the public sector, you can get money that's not far off that. You just can't get it as an MP, right? And I just think it is ridiculous, given that the MP's job is so important, that at least there shouldn't be that kind of money available. It's mad that you can earn that kind of money as a vice chancellor. There are positions in the health service where you can earn that kind of money, but you can't earn it as an MP. That's mad, right?
So if they're properly remunerated, then you would ban outside work. So you lose that.
It should be completely consistent with all sorts of reforms. Like you can't have a nice little earner on the side if you're an MP. Now, the other thing I would do, because I would want these people to focus exclusively on the measures that would make this country a happier, more successful place, is I would take away from that chamber the link with individual constituencies. And what I would do is I would then reshape the House of Lords, or the upper chamber, whether you'd want to call it the House of Lords anymore, I doubt, but that would be a wholly elected chamber, and those representatives there would be the ones with the community link. They would represent a specific part of the country, maybe even the existing constituencies. They would be a revising chamber. They wouldn't have the powers of the main legislative house. They would be a revising chamber, but they would retain that connection with voters. So it's a very radical proposal. We'll see whether this proposal or ones as bold get traction after the election. But I do think among the many things that need to change are, the way that we do democracy. By simply making this suggestion, what I was trying to say is the time for half, this economy has stagnated for way too long. We're getting the kind of fractures in the country, who we think we are as a nation, who we think we are as individuals. We've seen these fractures that are doing enormous damage. So the time for half measures is past. And so I just want us in general to be bolder. Because, the twin, the twin things that are wrong in this country. One is the unfairness of the way the economy works, that millions of people rightly say the economy doesn't work for me. I can't have the standard of living that I want. And to an extent, and they're right to think this, that they deserve. They're working incredibly hard, but they still have to use food banks. Public services absolutely creaking at the seams. So that's one bucket of essentially problems that need to be fixed by a different way of managing the economy. And then there's a separate bucket which falls into the sort of social cultural sphere, which is desperate mistrust of all politicians, of all parties, confidence in our elected representatives to make stuff better for us at an all-time low. And then, you know, all that noise and anger, which has been massively exacerbated by social media, within the broader debate. I mean, you know, so it's broadly, the two things that are wrong are an economy that, as I say, unfortunately only serves a limited number, and then a society which is now characterized by recriminations and anger rather than a sense of common purpose.
So we have about 10 minutes or so left. I just wanted to touch on a couple of other suggestions from different aspects of your book. I mean, you propose a policy equivalent of the OBR to examine policies and sort of what consequences, unintended or otherwise, might come of them. You have an excellent suggestion for a unit that would look at what's called long tail risks. So these are things like COVID that are unlikely, but if they were to happen, have a massive downside effect on the economy and our welfare. Coming to money and the ability of the government to raise money, you have spoken about on the rest is money, the risk that come the autumn, the way the government sort of spending and financial planning works is obviously predicated on the Office of Budget Responsibility's forecasts, which have been argued to be very optimistic. There is an argument that they will revise those forecasts, and come the autumn, there'll suddenly be a £30 billion black hole in the government finances. Now, one of the suggestions you make for raising money relates to the interest payments that the Bank of England make to banks on the reserves that they hold. Now, if I understand it right, QE, quantitative easing, created a bunch of money. The Bank of England created debt, which was bought by the banks, which is held by them. And as interest rates have gone up, so the Bank of England have had to pay this money to the banks. And the argument goes that if we can freeze those payments, or even a portion of those payments, those reserves add up to, the reserves that the banks hold is around 900 billion. That would create a huge windfall for the government. So, I mean, do correct me if I've understood any part of that wrongly, but I love the idea.
I'm just going to gallop through all of that because we haven't got long. So, look, first of all, you know, we need to change the whole culture of government so that this ambition of generating fair, sustainable growth is sort of within the entire culture of government, right? Now, at the moment, we've got this independent body called the OBR, whose whole point is to try to, force the government to be mindful of the sustainability of the public finances. It's essentially about trying to prevent any government from borrowing too much, right? And that is a perfectly legitimate ambition. And, you know, I would broadly argue that the creation of the Office of Budget Responsibility was a sensible reform. But what is not in the culture of government enough across the piece is this idea that policies should only rarely be enacted if they are going to be very damaging to our growth prospects. So, you know, what one would like to see is a body that would have two responsibilities. Now, I should say that Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, says she will give the Treasury on its own as the most important department a sort of growth mandate that's different from its current mandate, right? I mean, I broadly take the view that that's not enough. There is an argument for saying you just need an entire new department that's dedicated to growth and the economy. Somebody like Andy Haldane, former chief economist at the Bank of England, would take that view. Maybe we need to go down that path. We did try that in the UK in the 1960s, the sort of infighting within government that caused meant that it was it was abandoned. You know, that may be the right way to go. Actually, I just think what we need is the equivalent of an OBR that would examine big policies and just say that good or bad for growth, would have initiating power as well. But then there's a third thing that it needs to do, which I talk about in the book. What I envisage, historically, for decades, Britain, particularly the private sector, but also the public sector, has invested way less than our competitor economies. And we are continuing to invest way less than our competitor economies. And my view is, it should be, you could even legislate for this, it might be a good idea. I do think that we should have as a central aim of government to invest at least at the average for rich developed economies. You might call it the OECD average. And I think on a rolling cycle, in the way that, for example, there's a rolling cycle for determining what government departments should spend, on a rolling cycle, there should be an evaluation of what kind of tax breaks, for example, should we give the private sector to encourage the private sector to invest more in a sensible way up to that OECD average, and what kind of investment is the public sector not doing that would be growth enhancing. And so you'd have the equivalent of what's called the comprehensive spending review. It would be the sort of comprehensive investment review on a rolling 2 or 3 year basis. And the point of it would be to keep front and center for any government the imperative of getting investment up to a level that gives us a fighting chance of getting productivity up to levels that they have in places like France, Germany, Scandinavia, America, and therefore both growth and living standards up to those sorts of levels. So that would be one incredibly important reform that I'd like to see. Now, you talked about, I'm just going to quickly summarise the position on the Bank of England's, well, I'm quickly going to summarise the position on the reserves held by our commercial banks at the Bank of England, right? Those reserves, they reached a peak of £800-900 billion. They're now, I think, somewhere around £800 billion, right? And they went through the roof because when the Bank of England, supported by the government, embarked off on what's known as quantitative easing, after 2008, they bought enormous amounts of debt, government debt. And in the process of buying that debt from the banks' reserves at the Bank of England increased massively. There's this thing called the bank rate, which is the benchmark interest rate for the entire economy, which is set by the Bank of England. It's currently 5.25%. For much of the QE period, it was, for a period, it was 0.25%, right? It was, and that bank rate, currently 5.25%, is the amount of interest that the Bank of England pays the banks on those enormous deposits, right? It's an enormous amount of income, 30 or 40 billion a year, that the Bank of England is paying the banks. But the important point about it from the point of view of the government and taxpayers is that under an agreement between the government and the Bank of England, that interest is actually paid by taxpayers, right? It's a taxpayer bill, right? So there's a bill of about 35 to 40 billion a year, roughly, from taxpayers to Britain's commercial banks. Now, one of the things that is very striking is the European Central Bank, all central banks, right, as a result of QE, quantitative easing, inflated the reserves that their banks held at the respective central bank. So, for example, you know, Eurozone banks also have enormous reserves at the ECB. The ECB does not reward those banks, does not pay interest to those commercial banks at that official rate, except on a small proportion of the reserves. They do not pay that interest rate on all the reserves. And therefore, the proposal that I made in the book is that basically the UK should adopt an approach which is closer to what they do in the Eurozone, which is, it's not to say the bank shouldn't get that rate on what you might call the core reserves that they need to hold at the bank for financial stability reasons, but they should not be getting that rate on the bunch of their reserves that are sort of exceptional and are there because of QE. Now, that doesn't mean, to be clear, that there is an available windfall of, I don't know, let's call it 35 billion, 40 billion a year. I was quite amused because I made this recommendation when I published the book months and months and months ago. I was quite amused that actually the Reform Party is the only party which has adopted this proposal.
Oh, brilliant!
And they and they've put in their slightly fictional profit and loss account for how they're going to, slash taxes and increase public spending. They have included the full 35, 40 billion windfall, because they have a proposal which says basically we'll stop rewarding the banks at all on this money, and we'll get a 35 to 40 billion windfall. I don't think that would be practical or sensible. It would, for a whole variety of reasons, not least of which is there is no such thing as a completely victimless, painless tax. If you took all of that money away from the banks, truthfully, one of the things they would do is they would increase the amount they charge borrowers to get the money back, or they would cut the amount they pay depositors. So, there would be indirect harm to bank customers. So my view is you can probably get, 50, 20 billion of it back. That is a win. It is effectively a windfall tax on the banks. And I think that, let's be clear, in the current circumstances, where there is a black hole in the public finances, 15 to 20 billion pounds is very, very useful money. Very useful for the health service result. And just to, finally, on the point that you raise about the black hole in the public finances, just to explain what that is.
Yeah.
Okay. There are two elements to it. One is all the main parties, but let's just focus for a second on Labour and the Tories. They have said, they will fund a very expensive workforce plan for the NHS and increase spending in the NHS, that they will support schools, they will aim for defence spending to go up to 2.5% of national income GDP compared to 2.3%, which is where it is at the moment. They've said they'll protect, the state pension in real terms. They've made a whole series of expensive commitments around official projections for public spending, which show that the so-called envelope for all of public spending is only going to rise 1%. And both parties have signed up for that. Basically, what that means is if you were going to stick to all of those things, then you would have to significantly reduce spending on the courts and the police and the so-called non-protected areas. And, in order to protect those areas, you might have to raise something like 19 or 20 billion pounds. So that's one element of the black hole that, needs to be filled if you're simply going to keep public services in their current creaking state. And then finally, the other element is it is likely the last time the OBR ran the numbers, they were too optimistic about productivity and growth. They are likely to have to reduce their growth and productivity numbers, which means tax revenues will be less, which means there might be another 10, 20 billion that has to be found. So, you know, there is a potential backhoe of about 40 billion pounds. Whoever wins the election is going to have to find around 40 billion pounds. It's a big sum of money.
It's a huge sum of money. I think what you've outlined and given us all today is that really clear sense that on the one hand, we're able to find areas in government and the economy to be optimistic about. Understanding aspects of that, that it's really complicated, but feels clear when I speak to you and when I read your book, I have to say. And that element of hope, especially with all the suggestions that you mention at the end, is really, really inspiring. And I do hope that some of them sort of meander their way in some shape or form or other into government policy. I have no idea how ideas become government policy. That is an alchemy that is beyond me.
But it is a sort of... Is the expression a random walk? I don't know. I mean, it's you know, having been in this space for 30, 40 years, the truth is all you can do if you do what I do is, you know, put ideas out there and hope at some point it resonates with somebody who might be in a position to actually do something.
Well, Robert Peston, I hope that is the case. Thank you very, very much for joining us today. And I would encourage everybody to buy the book. Enjoy the rest of his Money podcast, which is fantastic. And it's definitely a weekly listen for me. And for summer reading, I will be picking up The Crash, The Adventures of Gil Peck.
Lovely to talk to you.